Thank you. Good morning, everyone. I am, as Chris said, I'm Mark Pesce. I am also, by the way, the honorary adjunct in this program, which means that I am available to you more or less continuously when you have questions. I am a resource. By the end of this, you'll have an idea of what kind of resource I am. Feel free to make use of me as a resource. All right. So I have a history and background in virtual reality. We will be spending some time looking at that. But I will also be spending most of this talk focusing on the thing that's coming next that you maybe haven't heard a lot about, and I'm going to sort of take it from a couple of different angles, both as an emerging technology and how it's also going to be used in your practice, how that's going to work. But let's start way back in the 1950s, even before I was born. Now, that is a jet fighter cockpit from 1950, F-86. There was a point that got reached in the early 1950s with instrumentation. Instrumentation became more complex than a single pilot could take in at a particular time. They were trying to fly this and fight an enemy fighter and stay in the air. And you can take a look at all of those dials. If a pilot has to be across all of those dials and integrating all of that information simultaneously, what had happened was the complexity of the machine surpassed the capacity of the pilot to control the machine. And so they had to start to think about techniques to be able to synthesize this information in a digestible form so that a pilot could make decisions quickly based on the best available information that was being filtered and fed to them. So, a few years later, the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency, or DARPA, gets started up. This is in the late 1950s, and it starts to fund a whole bunch of research projects in this area. By 1968, that's 50 years ago now, the first of those research projects came to fruit. So that's Ivan Sutherland. Have you ever heard of Ivan Sutherland? Okay. This is the first bit of education we need to do. Ivan Sutherland, in 1963, again as part of a DARPA project, created a program called Sketchpad. Sketchpad was the first interactive computer program, full stop. It was also, basically, Photoshop. Maybe a scaled-down version, but you had a light pen, you were drawing on a screen, and it was drawing on the screen. It was completely new, completely revolutionary. No one had ever seen anything like it before, and it completely changed the way people thought about interacting with computers, because there was nothing like that before it. So he goes away for 5 years and comes back and creates... Let's start this up again. The head-mounted display. That video is from YouTube. That is actually a head-mounted display that is head tracking and positional tracking because it's attached to something in the ceiling, and as you're moving around in the ceiling, it is tracking you in X, Y, and Z, and as you're moving around, it's tracking the yaw, pitch, and roll of the head. All right, so these are all of the elements for a fully realized virtual reality system. And in fact, it's not just virtual reality, it's augmented reality because the whole thing is see-through. So it's projecting out into the world because the problem he's trying to solve is the problem for the jet fighter. And the jet fighter can't be in a virtual world, they have to be in an augmented world. So this is, we're coming on to the 50th anniversary of this. Ivan Sutherland's still alive, he's in his 80s. He's actually shocked that virtual reality hasn't evolved much past this basic idea. Because this is basically all of the ideas of virtual and augmented reality in a single realized form. Now, computers were ridiculously expensive back then. There was no such thing as 3D hardware. You had to basically solder it together on your own. Everything about this was hard and weird and strange. So although it was profoundly influential, it took almost 20 years for it to really start to come into its form. So this is the virtual environment workstation. This is the first system that most people think of as being real VR. This photo is from 89. The work was actually done between 85 and 89 at the NASA Ames Research Center. And it was done there to create an environment that would allow astronauts to practice missions in orbit before they actually got out of the space shuttle to fix whatever they were trying to fix. Because normally they would practice their missions, of course, in big tanks of water on the ground and go through them and rehearse them and rehearse them. And if you have an additional mission in orbit, how do you do this? So they created this system. And of course, it has the basic hallmarks of a virtual reality system. It has the head-mounted display, which is producing a stereo pair so that slightly different images are going into each eye. And it has what are called data gloves. These are gloves that have metallic sensors in them so they can detect not just the position. There's a position tracker in the base of each hand there, but also flexion sensors so you can detect how your fingers are extended or moving. So you can point, you can gesture. So this is even for something that's basically 30 years ago, is still quite advanced. This was connected to about a $2 million supercomputer that was generating the images that was going into the head-mounted display. At this point, you did have graphics computers, but they were multi-million dollar machines. All right? This has become the archetype. All virtual reality systems that you see now are basically versions of this. This became the archetype. This became the launching off point for 1,000 bad cyberpunk novels, Ready Player One, whatever you want to do. But it became, this is the image that we hold. Now, very soon thereafter, Nintendo said, ooh, those data gloves are really interesting. We should actually make one of those. And so they basically took it and reverse engineered it. And they came up with the Power Glove, which was released at Christmas time in 1989. The Power Glove had a little sensor, an ultrasonic sensor that you put on top of the television set, and it would detect the orientation of the hand in space. So you could actually detect the yaw and pitch of the hand in space, and it had the controller here. And it worked, and it would work with your normal Super Nintendo system games. So it would be a controller for them, and there were some games that were specifically written for this. Nintendo sold a boatload of them that Christmas, and let me tell you what happens. The kids unwrapped it. Ah! They put it on, and they start playing the game. Now, I have a small experiment for you. I want you to hold your hand out in front of you, like this. Extended, yeah, like that. Okay, this was the position that was required to use the Power Glove. You could not deviate from this position, because if you deviated from this position, you would lose the tracking, because the tracking was between the end of the hand and the television set. Do you notice that maybe they made a small boo-boo when they were doing their user testing, which apparently they didn't do, because you can't do this for more than a minute, particularly not if you're a little kid. When I do this in classes, the longest I've ever seen is a girl held it for 6 minutes. She was practically blue at the end. You can put it down now. But you see what I'm talking about. We can make these amazing technologies that are very close to the body. But we can forget that when we make technologies that are close to the body, they can ask the body to do things that the body shouldn't be doing. So they sold a boatload, and then a boatload of these went into a landfill. Now, completely undeterred by that failure, I decided to start a company to create a consumer virtual reality system. We figured we could get it to market for around $1,200 in early 1990. This is when I entered the field. There were a number of problems we had to get through to get a VR system from costing $1 million down to costing $1,200. One of them was being able to do orientation sensing, where the yaw, pitch, and roll of the head, which is one of the fundamental features of virtual reality. We solved that problem. As soon as we solved that problem, another small company came calling because they were also working on a virtual reality system. That company was Sega. Now, Sega had just dethroned Nintendo as the biggest company in video gaming in the early 1990s. And at the Consumer Electronics Show in 1993, so just a little bit more than 25 years ago, we, working with them, showed off the prototype version of what was called the Sega Virtua VR. So this was designed to be plugged into a Sega Genesis, also known as the Master System here, an 8 megahertz processor, driving a virtual reality system. And we showed it to the buyers at the Consumer Electronics Show. And I want you to picture, Sega has this huge booth, and as you get deeper and deeper into the booth, because it's quite high security to go and see this demo, it gets dimmer and dimmer and dimmer. And then you're in a very dimly lit room, because you don't want to look at something that's basically a miner's helmet with a lot of stuff gaffer taped onto it, because it was a prototype, and that's what they did. We showed it to the buyers. The buyers went wild. So Walmart's going to order a bunch. Target's going to order a bunch. Kmart's going to order a bunch. Everyone's going to order tons of them. We then get it through manufacturing, and we send it out to testing. And through testing, it becomes clear that when you give this to kids, it's going to make them sick. And Sega's lawyers basically said to them, you're opening yourselves up for the largest product liability lawsuit in history. And so the product was never formally killed. Now, mind you, this is real. It made the cover of Popular Science, product of the year. Sega just stopped talking about it. All right. Which bad for my startup went down in flames because we were licensing a part to a product that just kind of disappeared. That's all right. I found other things to do with my time because I was still very interested in virtual reality. And so about a year after that, a little less than a year after that, I took something that was brand new. There was this brand new thing called the World Wide Web, which was just starting to come into being late 93, early 94 was really when it started to have an inflection point. And I created a three-dimensional interface to the World Wide Web called VRML. And this is the first model that Tony, who did the work with me, and I created in VRML. It was the cyber banana, as we call it. So my work is the foundation for all the work in 3D graphics on the World Wide Web that you see today. So WebGL you can think of as sort of the descendant, sort of the great-grandchild of the work that we were doing in 93 and 1994. And I thought that this would be very important because I could see the value of taking networking and the web and all of the resources of that and bringing that in with virtual reality. Okay. Here's the thing. The virtual reality systems back then cost millions of dollars, sometimes tens of millions of dollars. When you try to make them less expensive, they didn't work well because VR just has a certain number of entrance requirements before it's going to work well enough. We could do things on the screen, but even with VRML in the early days, because computers didn't really have any capacity to be able to do really good 3D graphics in the early 90s. We had good software rendering, but that was it. Even to get mainstream acceptance of this in the early 1990s, what year is Toy Story, the original film? 90? Is it 95? 94, right? Okay. That's the first time most people had ever seen 3D graphics and not real time. And we were actually going, oh, you could do real time stuff. And so some of this was pretty far ahead of its time. But the interesting thing is, this then happened. So VR died. You know what didn't die? Video games. And so in a 20-year period, do you know Moore's Law? Every 18 to 24 months, computers get twice as fast for half as much money. We've kind of petered out on that lately, but you know, until 2016, it was ticking over fairly reliably. And so for the same amount of hardware, for the same $300 worth of hardware, that's a PlayStation over there, and that's a PlayStation 4 over here. So you can sort of see the difference in the quality here. All of a sudden, when you get to this point, a whole bunch of stuff becomes possible that was just too hard or too expensive or too specialized to work at scale before. And this is where VR takes off again. Between 2014 and 2016 is what the inflection point was that allowed virtual reality to take off again. Okay, that's history. That's sort of what has been going on. Now what I'm going to do is I'm going to talk to you about what is coming. What I'm going to do is give you a path toward around the next 5 years and a key technology that's going to be part of the landscape that you're probably going to be working in within the next 5 years called videogrammetry. Now, you all know about photogrammetry. Do you know what photogrammetry is? Which is being able to take a whole bunch of photos of something and from those photos abstract a 3D model of the thing that you're photographing, right? The original paper on photogrammetry, I remember it was presented at SIGGRAPH in like 93 or 94. I remember it caused quite a stir. Oh my God, you can take 2D photos and produce a 3D model. It was a really good idea. It really caught on. It is, for 1992, 93, enormously computationally expensive. For 92, 93, but of course now there's software packages that will do it for you. That's what is it called, PhotoScan, right? Which is designed to sort of feed it all in and there it is and produce the model. And if you're trying to photograph something, there are many different approaches. You can take one camera and use it a lot, or you can take a lot of cameras and use it once. So this is not an untypical rig because you're trying to get as much coverage from the model as you can, because the more coverage you get in the model, the more accurate the output model is going to be. Okay, this was state of the art through around 2015, 2016, was photogrammetry. The next place that we're going is photogrammetry plus a timeline, that is videogrammetry. Oh wait, I've gone ahead of myself. You have the Vive set up here, and both the Steam Home, but there's a specific app called Destinations, which is a photogrammetry exploration app. And there are some beautiful places. This one is a Gothic church in England. There are some beautiful places to explore. This thing, I think, was captured with around 10,000 photographs, but it's an entire landscape and you can work your way through. I would spend some time in here because it gives you a sense of the amazing sense of place that you can actually get inside of photogrammetry when it's done well. All right. Okay. So that's sort of, this is state-of-the-art photogrammetry where we've gone. Now we're going to videogrammetry. So it's photogrammetry plus time. Now the fellow who's holding my 360 camera there, so he's sort of cut in half, that's Link Gaskin. He's the founder of a company called 8i, which kind of came out of Weta in Wellington, although it's mostly based in Los Angeles now. And he was showing me his capture room. And so his capture room is basically a large dome-shaped area. And you see these are high-definition cameras. I think at the time they were only normal high-definition. I think now they're ultra-high-definition cameras. There's 40 of them. And I think he was quite careful on how he took the photo because he didn't want the exact layout of those cameras revealed because it happens to be proprietary information. What it does is you suck in the data from all 40 of those cameras. You then upload it to an enormous amount of computing power in the cloud, which, again, we didn't have until a few years ago. And what it does is frame by frame, it composites something, composites the model who's standing in the middle on a timeline. So frame by frame by frame. So it's like doing photogrammetry, but frame by frame by frame. And this was incredibly computationally expensive. I think at the time that he shot this, to do a single minute would take 10 hours of compute time. All right, and that's not a single computer. That's using an entire bank of computers somewhere out at Amazon. And so 8i is now starting. They have an app called Holo. You can download that for your various devices, for your various smartphone devices, and they capture a lot of performances by people in this. And when I was visiting this day, I actually had a session inside the Vive with a boxing coach. And the interesting thing is when you capture human performance in videogrammetry, it doesn't have the uncanny valley. It jumps right over it because you've captured a human performance. And so the way the model is moving in three space, because it's a three-dimensional model, is completely realistic. Your brain just goes, of course that's a person, because it wasn't recreated. It wasn't, there's no sense that it's synthetic. And this is the enormous difference that you're getting. So let me show you, this is a little bit of propaganda from 8i, but it'll show you what they did with a boxer here. And you won't see that much of, you see how you only see little bits of the room they're using for shooting? Again, it's because it's proprietary. But they're doing the capture now. And then we're going to see actually how it looks in the Holo app. So you see how you get that high quality capture. And that's augmented reality. So you're seeing that through the screen of the smartphone and they've dropped the performance in there and it's just playing. So you can grab the Holo app and check this out for yourself because it's all in the Holo app. But you've got real performance capture in there. So it's not recreated, it's real. Okay, second piece I'm going to show you is called Joshua Bell VR. Now Joshua Bell is a Sony musician. This is a PSVR app that will show you what videogrammetry is really like. And better than that, it is now installed on that PSVR. I made sure of that, all right? You should check it out. It's only 4 minutes long. It's really amazing because what you're going to see is that when you're in the space where he's performing, and it's him on violin and a pianist right next to him, you can look around. And it's not like looking around in 360 video. You can look around because you're actually present in the space. So this is from, they did this work in 2015, 2016. So, and this is, again, this is relatively early in the modern era of videogrammetry, so they really did do capture, model, put everything into Unity, place it all. And so it's this interesting almost blend between what we would think of as something that's fully synthetic and something that's fully realized. It's this marrying point, and this is why it's going to be making a lot of work for you guys, because that's kind of the place where you're going to be living for the next couple of years of your career. All right. So this was sort of late 2015, early 2016. I seen the work at 8i in early 2016, and then in April of 2016, Microsoft came out with something that was pretty amazing. Okay, so again, this is Microsoft Research. Effectively, they have a whole bunch of these cameras similar to Kinects, but 3D cameras doing all of this, doing all the capture. Apparently, they had a room full of computers next door that was doing this integration process of the data from the cameras so it could produce the integrated model. But that was enough to get a lot of people thinking, wait a minute, this is probably not as hard as Microsoft made it look. I mean, obviously, this is a first pass, so they were going to do it the hard way. What we're now seeing is that the bottom is dropping out of the requirements to be able to do this. And this is now not something where you capture a minute of footage and then you spend 10 hours processing it and then you have something. This is real time. All right, this is the key element here. So we're going from this idea that you're capturing and then later displaying to something that can now effectively be a broadcast tool. Yes, I'm going to go there. A couple more slides, I'm going to go there. But let's just take a look, because now there's a whole bunch of work that's starting to emerge around how that might look, even on a testing basis. So the first one of these is EFEV. EFEV requires two connect twos. There's one there. We'll turn that on in a second. Basically pointed at opposite sides of you. So if I were, had connect two on that side and a connect two on this side, they'd be capturing both sides of me. They'd be integrating that data, producing that videogrammic model, which I could then drop into something in Unity or wherever for playback. And that looks like this. All right. So, you know, is it great? It's not bad. Compositing kind of sucks. But for what it is, and for the fact that it costs around $500 in components, and you can do it, this is the first generation, and this app is still very much in development. So is it great? It's not great. It's not horrible, right? But it shows you that the bottom is dropping out of the capacity to be able to do this. This is something that could be done in a normal studio. So they're not the only team doing this. They're doing this, and then there's another team called DepthKit who are also doing it. They only use one connect, so you sit here and do it, but of course they're only getting the front sides, which is why you only see the front side of this man. But there are approaches, they all use some sort of depth camera, and right now the default on that is a Kinect 2. There is a new thing called the RealSense from Intel, which is kind of like a smaller version of the Kinect 2 that Intel is now selling boatloads of and is getting wired into a lot of these systems. But we're going to go to the demo now, because there's nothing like a demo to sort of show you what's going on here.